Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, December 2nd, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include: what is one of the main causes for chronic disease that usually goes unnoticed?
And how well does ibuprofen and or Tylenol work for colds and flus?
And can microbes in the gut cause colon cancer?
And what does the brain have to do with type 2 diabetes?
And why are people going out of the country to get medical care these days?
Well, these are some interesting topics here. Can you believe that we're already into December?
Gosh. Hard to believe. Christmas is only a couple of weeks away.
I thought we just had summer.
I know. Thanksgiving was just a couple of minutes ago.
So now we get to try to take that weight off, or we're going to put some more on.
You know, the average person between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day gains 8 pounds. So that's the time, if you could just stay even, you're ahead of the game, and maybe those 8 pounds that you would have put on, you'll take off next year.
Well, you know, if you really do like somebody and care about them, don't give them all that
all the chocolate,
all those cookies and everything. Yeah, because it's too tempting to have it around.
I know. We do so well, and then Thanksgiving comes along, and it's sort of like we get a license to eat. It's Thanksgiving. You got to eat everything, and everybody gets indigestion. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, that's the busiest time in the emergency room, too.
I'll say the day after Thanksgiving is a nightmare for doctors. It's amazing how many people. That Friday when I was taking night calls with my call group, that was one day we all drew straws to see who would have to take it.
I was reading an article in the Moore Magazine November issue of this year about Sarah, who was a victim of domestic violence. And I was surprised to learn that it's one of the main causes of chronic diseases, and it often goes unnoticed or undiagnosed, you know, domestic violence. Women often hide it, and the doctors and the nurses and the dentists, they often just don't even ask.
Isn't
they just
hard
ignore
to believe?
It.
It's sort of like there's an elephant in the room and nobody's talking about it. Maybe they just don't expect that it's as common as it is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, and I was surprised, too, at some of the health effects from the abuse and this living in constant fear. That's like the biggest thing because
all that stress hormones for a long time are a disaster.
And even years later, when the woman thinks that the violence is over, and that was what happened with this Sarah that wrote the article, because mm-hmm. she thought she'd left it behind her after she finally left her husband, and she couldn't leave it behind her because of the post-traumatic stress.
You know, I see people in my practice all the time, Vicki, 30, 40, 50, 60, sometimes even 70 years later, and those effects are still there for a lot of them. It's amazing how the dysfunctional ways we learn to behave as a child and as a young adult stay with us until we do something to change that.
I know, and many times it's carried on from one generation to the next, because it doesn't
Absolutely.
Just affect the spouse, but it affects the children that are witnessing it.
Sure, they learn how to behave that way.
Exactly.
I mean, if a kid sees his father beating up his mother, he thinks that violence is okay. It's a terrible thing to teach them.
And the daughters might think that it's okay to
be abused.
Yeah, to be abused.
Or expect that that's how it is.
So maybe, we're going to talk about some of the diseases that are caused from domestic violence. But first, let's talk about how widespread domestic violence is.
It's shocking that 1 in 4 women, Vicki, 25% of all women in America, experience severe domestic violence. And 2 million are injured. A fourth of them require medical care. And there are 1,300 deaths. The emergency room stats show that 60% of these women who show up there have been strangled, and about a third of them lost consciousness from it. It's unbelievable.
And most of the time it's ignored.
Well, you know, I think the doctors don't think of that. You know, they're busy enough doing what they do.
This article was talking about how scary that is to have your air cut off.
Mm.
And that she says that she's afraid now to even fly in an airplane because she gets that fear again.
Feel.
It stirs it up again about her fear of losing her breath. Yeah. That you could get a stroke from it. You get memory loss, and it's much like probably having just having a head injury. Well, a lot of these women get head injuries.
They used to kill people by hanging them. Okay, that's the same thing. So it's not something that's a minor thing. And to see that massive kind of trauma occurring to somebody tells you that there's something awfully wrong with the way that couple was raised.
Well, maybe just because the doctors and the nurses or the dentists are afraid and uncomfortable to bring it up themselves.
Or they don't even look for it. I mean, they're busy trying to fix things. They're not so much, especially in an emergency room. They're not
Well, one girl said she was so hoarse, and the doctor said, "You sure must have been screaming at your husband a lot."
Well, you know, maybe that was taken out of context. I can't imagine a doctor really saying something like that.
Well, maybe he was an abuser.
Well, could be. Could be. But it's the kind of thing that is so common, and you have to wonder, why is it so taboo? And part of it, I think, is because doctors are trying to just fix things. How much time do you have in the emergency room to be taking a mental or spiritual history from somebody? That's sort of like where you put the Band-Aids on, or you put the casts on, or you make decisions about what to do, and you assume that if there's some kind of violence that's domestic goes with it, then maybe some of the authorities will take care of it. But who are the authorities? It's them.
I had a friend that used to be drawn to men that would beat her up because her father beat her up.
Right. She was used to it.
It was like all she'd have to do is go into a room and she'd always pick the guy that was going to beat her up.
She'd know, yeah.
And they would just like beat her up really bad. She lost teeth. She had black eyes, bad neck. She broke bones. She fell downstairs. She just had one thing after another. And it just seemed like it just never stopped.
I think it shows you that when we're in our comfort zone, whatever it is, and we know how to navigate through that system, whether it be domestic violence or it be something that's a good thing, we stay in that frame of mind because we know how to navigate through it. It's not like because it's bad, we're not going to do it. It's more frightening to be in a situation where you don't know what to expect because you're unused to it.
One time she told me that the guys that were nice were just boring.
Well, yeah.
But I'm not saying that all women in domestic violence are in that particular type of a situation. A lot of them, they're just living in fear all the time. They're scared to death and they're afraid to leave.
Well, they're stalked by their husbands. They're threatened that they'll take their kids away or the kids will be hurt. I mean, it's a terrible thing to be living a life like that. And look at all the medical effects from that. You know, stress is a good thing if it's short term. Because you need to be able to respond in an emergency and have all your senses working better than normal.
Fight or flight.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. But when it gets more to be more than a couple of weeks or a month, now you're looking at the effects of cortisol for a long period of time or adrenaline hormones or other hormones that come into play that have profound effects on our health.
Well, we're always talking about how inflammation is like a
exactly.
major cause of disease, and that's what happens. You get inflammation, and then you can have your coronary arteries can get plugged up, and you can get hypertension, and your metabolism changes, and it inflames your respiratory passages, and then you get asthma and sinus infections, and it goes on. You get stomach problems, GI problems.
Well, I think that women who are abused and they're in this hyper reactive state where they're hyper vigilant. The study was done out of the University of California in San Francisco showing that their telomeres were short. What does that mean?
Their DNA.
Telomeres are the ends of the chromosomes. And when those telomeres are shortened, it's a sign that your life is shortened as well. And so not only are they going to live less long, but they're associated with a lot of illnesses. So they're seeing the physiological age is 10 years more on the average than their chronological age. So someone who's 30 might look and be as healthy as somebody who's 40 years old. So this is far-reaching effects that go beyond the psychological challenges that women face in that setting.
Well, it really does cause a lot of diseases. You know, we were saying chronic diseases, and many of these women have more than one chronic disease at a time. I think it was 2.7.
Compared to 1.7 number of illnesses, that's right.
So many of them have arthritis. Now, We don't usually talk about how arthritis can be caused by a previous trauma, but that can.
Well, it is. That's a traumatic arthritis. That's like a football player who's got a bad knee or a bad ankle or a torn shoulder or a rotator cuff.
And when
or,
they get older, then they get arthritis.
Then you, well,
get a
yeah.
knee replacement and all the problems that go with that.
Well, exactly.
Well, then also diabetes. Who would think that you could get a high blood sugar from being abused?
Well,
but the cortisol, I guess.
When you have high levels of cortisol, these stress hormones, they upset glucose metabolism, and it allows the blood sugar to be higher, and it makes insulin not as sensitive as it normally is. And a lot of these women will come up with type 2 diabetes. You get osteoporosis and hypertension and cancer. I mean, the risk of all these diseases should go up when you're seeing inflammation. It's
well, many
chronic.
Times we do think of things associated with stress like hypertension, mm-hmm. you know, high blood pressure
sure.
or asthma.
Sure.
And maybe insomnia. But the insomnia, I think, that's caused in these women is from too much cortisone.
It's a hyperreactivity.
Cortisol.
It's the hypervigilance. They don't sleep deeply. They don't go into REM sleep that well.
And you never know somebody's going to haul off and sock you.
Well, yeah, unexpectedly. Somebody comes home drunk and all of a sudden you're, you know, being beat up. I mean, this is
and, bad, you know, a lot of times people talk about tension headaches. Well, they get very severe headaches. Well, they've had their head smashed in the wall or whatever a few times. And irritable bowel syndrome, things like that. And then there's the psychosomatic side.
Well, those are real things that people have. Just because they're caused by emotional factors doesn't mean that the physical disability is any less. In fact, it's interesting that the amygdala, which is the emotion center of the brain where we hold our feelings, keeps track of all the traumas we've had, and it kind of blurs them together so that they individually don't stand out so much, and you just remember that you're in that state where you're getting lots of trauma. And when that happens, it makes the nervous system more reactive to pain so that it takes a lot less pain to make people suffer. And they have this thing called neuropathic pain, which is very difficult to treat, that's neurologically
You think when they
based.
Were hit around that much that they have a higher tolerance for
well,
pain?
Well, they get used to that part, but their body reacts to it in a way where they anticipate with fear so much that the centers of the brain are activated. So this is, I mean, there's so many things that go wrong with chronic stress.
Well, this leads to post-traumatic stress disorder in these people too. It's not just the military that we frequently associate that with, but all these abusive memories keep resounding that alarm in them, and then they keep reliving it mm-hmm. over and over again. What happened to them? It's just held in their gut and their psyche and in their heart.
Everywhere. Even in the immune system. And as I said, it even affects your DNA. And as we know, epigenetics, those factors in the environment are more powerful at manipulating DNA than the DNA itself. So if we're exposed to chronic stress and lots of fear, certain genes will be switched on and off. And the way that our body will run itself depends on that.
Well, many times people don't think of sex in a marriage as being an assault or a rape and this kind of a thing. But you talk to women that are victims of domestic violence,
oh,
and
right.
they'll tell you that they've been sexually assaulted.
Well, it's not consensual. Because it's actually not even legal. You're not supposed to rape your wife. It should be a consensual sex. I mean, that's what marriage should be about anyway. And if it's not, then there's something wrong with the marriage.
Well, also there's the emotional abuse, the physical abuse, and then one of the things that they talked about in this article was the economic abuse of withholding money, because that's another form of it. But women need to be aware that they're risking brain damage.
Well, that's right. When you look at the amount of money that's spent, it's somewhere between $30 and $60 billion a year on this domestic violence. Women have more problems with their health. They spend about 20% more on their health than women that haven't had domestic violence.
Well, think about it. They get head injuries and soft tissue
sure.
injuries
sure.
and
well,
sinuses,
pretty straightforward.
Problems and bruises. And
so you have to ask yourself the question, what's wrong with our culture that allows something like this to develop? How are the men in the world being, how are the boys, the baby boys being raised?
Well, you know, you can look at some sports that are pretty rough. What about football?
Same thing. Well, it's the same thing. How were they raised? I mean, look at O.J., national hero, international hero. Turns out to have a real anger management problem, and that's an understatement.
Well, and then you watch some of these players, you know, that aren't very good sports.
Well, they're taught that. I mean, and that's something you learn from your family life. What if you're taught to not respect women? Or you're taught that violence is okay? Or that bullying is okay? All this leads to people who don't have a secure sense of self. You're not building community that way. And these are the underpinnings of why the boys, okay, in the community are that way. It's almost like you can't blame them, but you can't forgive them
either.
Well,
they're in an environment where they're learning to be that way.
Exactly. So you can understand it, and they need help. And this is the kind of thing that should be picked up in schools.
And then the girls are learning to be the victims.
To be abused.
Like
and that
my
it's okay.
friend that I was mentioning.
Sure.
Her father used to beat her up, so then she found all these guys that would beat her up.
Well, and look at how much incest there is. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of problems with families and friends of families abusing little girls and little boys. I mean, it's huge. I mean, it even gets into the church. I mean, you're talking about things that are widespread throughout the culture. So we need to do more education, and it should be done in our elementary schools so the kids know about this. And when we
yes, and know that that's not okay.
Exactly. And what is okay and why they're like that and what can be done about it, because we ought to be supporting both people. It's not just okay to put somebody in jail or to punish them for what they've done. That doesn't help the person that was punished or the person that was hurt, and it doesn't help the person really that was punished. We need to understand what's going on, and I'm not saying that it's okay. It's not okay. It should be punished. There should be consequences for it that will stop people from doing it. But we've got laws like that, and we still got 2 million people, 2 million women every year in the U.S. that are suffering from this abuse.
Well, then the other thing is, too, that many of them, because they have these chronic diseases, they end up on medications.
Oh, well.
And then many times they get side effects.
Well, medications
don't solve
the cause of anything. They may help with the symptoms so that you feel better. But they're, in the long run, helping a few people, but the vast majority of people that are stuck on a lot of drugs, that is not the right
answer.
Yes,
like if it's the cortisol that's disrupting their sleep. And then they give them a sleeping pill.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. What you got is one foot on the accelerator and another one on the brake. That's no way to drive a car, is it?
Or if the cortisol promotes insulin resistance, and so then you give them, a medication to help their insulin to work better.
Yeah. That's
or it accelerates arteriosclerosis, and then you give them statins or something.
Such a good point.
Those are just putting little Band-Aids on what the real cause is. So I think that your point about doing some of this somatic experiencing is a good idea.
Well, that's a way of getting more down towards the cause, but we should be looking at prevention and what can we do to stop this. And a lot of it is about education. And we should be educating parents. You know, parents that are getting married and having kids under the age of 20 or in their early 20s don't know the first thing most of the time about how to raise a kid.
Yeah. Well, also, when they find women that come to the emergency rooms or whatever, they need to
pay attention.
To talk to them in confidence.
Yeah.
And tell them and help them how to leave this situation, because that's when it's the deadliest, is it when women try to leave. The men get...
But it's the horses out of the barn by that time. You know, it's interesting. Only 27% of people with domestic violence have been screened, and only 24% have been asked during an exam about domestic violence as a possibility. So we've got a lot of things to do to educate that are going to change things, hopefully, for the good.
But if you notice that your boyfriend has this tendency, you need to find a way to get away from him. It's just not worth it in the long run.
You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on the wife from hell. The other side, we flipped the coin over now. Holy smoke.
The woman that gives a man a reason to want to hit her.
There you go. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how well does ibuprofen work for colds and flus.
Thank you. police officer pulls over a speeding car. The officer says, "I clocked you at 80 miles per hour, sir." And the driver says, "Well, gee, officer, I thought I had it on cruise control at 60 miles an hour. Perhaps your radar gun needs calibrating." Well, not looking up from her knitting, the wife says, "Now, don't be silly, dear. You know this car doesn't have cruise control."
Oh, jeez.
Well, as the officer writes out the ticket, the driver looks over at his wife and he growls, "Can't you please keep your mouth shut for once?" And the wife smiles demurely and she says, "You should be thankful your radar detector went off when it did." Well, as the officer makes out the second ticket for the illegal radar detector unit, the man just glares at his wife and says through clenched teeth, "Damn it, woman, can't you keep your mouth shut?" The officer frowns and he says, "And I notice that you're not wearing your seatbelt, sir. That's an automatic $75 fine." And the driver says, "Yeah, well, you see, officer, I had it on, but took it off when you pulled me over so that I could get my license out of my back pocket." And the wife says, "Now, dear, you know very well that you didn't have your seatbelt on. You never wear your seatbelt when you're driving." Well, as the police officer's writing out the third ticket, the driver turns to his wife and barks, "Why don't you just please shut up?" And the officer looks over at the woman and he asks, "Does your husband always talk to you this way, ma'am?" "Only when he's been drinking."
Oh, jeez. Talk about a reason for domestic violence, you know.
Well, there's no reason for hitting. There's other ways to handle things. But
yeah,
be thankful for the difficult people in your life, because they're the ones that have shown you exactly who you do not want to be.
And might be. That's right.
Yeah.
Wow. What a story.
When you get a cold with a sore throat and a cough.
Yeah, right.
What do you do for it?
You want something. Get me better. I don't want to be sick.
Do you take a Tylenol or an ibuprofen?
Right.
Well, a British study shows that neither of these meds provide any advantage, but instead they interfere with our immune response, and they can actually prolong or make the symptoms of a cold worse and lead to a more serious respiratory infection.
Wow. I mean, look at that. I mean, we know that the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Motrin and Advil and Aleve and Celebrex and the ones that have been taken off the market, like Bextra and Vioxx.
We already
know
those are
dangerous drugs that kill about 30,000 people a year in the U.S. every year and put about 300,000 in the hospital. And when we're sick, we want some kind of relief, so we go ahead and take something that gives us that risk.
It could make us a lot sicker.
And only to find out that it doesn't do any good for the symptoms.
So you need to remember it can cause a heart attack, a stroke, kidney failure, GI bleeding also. And then the Tylenol, that can cause liver problems, hearing problems, bleeding, and what else? Oh, if you're pregnant, you can harm your fetus.
Exactly.
But remember, most cold medicines contain acetaminophen. That's what Tylenol is. So if you start taking those medicines to think that it actually could make you worse.
Well, that's what this study showed, Vicki. There was a University of Southampton study that was published in the British Medical Journal in November of 2013. And they had 900 patients in the study, and they evaluated the amount of symptom relief there was and found out there was no benefit from using Advil or ibuprofen alone or in combination with Tylenol. And it didn't do anything to help the cold virus either.
And they also said that people that use steam tended to burn themselves.
Well, if it's hot steam, I suppose, but I mean,
well, I've tried that before. When they tell you to put hot steam in a bowl and put a towel over your head, it can be pretty hot.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, humidifiers are cool.
They're wonderful. What do? I mean, they liquefy all that mucus, that thick mucus that gets stuck down in your chest or in your sinuses, and liquefies it so you can bring it up.
It helps you to breathe, and it helps you to not cough. I mean, your nose doesn't get so stuffy. I mean, there are other things, too, that we can do for a cold, like irrigate your nose.
Tons of things.
You can irrigate your nose. Zinc lozenges for a sore throat. Another thing that I do for a sore throat is, and you do it, too, that ginger tea. Put ginger, cut it up, and add a little lemon and honey and warm water.
A little manuka honey is real good for
helpful.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
It helps clear up some of the symptoms, and you'll feel better. So here we have a situation where the thinking is we want to do something, do anything, and have the idea that we're going to feel better because of it and get well sooner. But really what we should be doing is taking care of ourselves better. You have to ask yourself the question, why did I get this cold?
You know, before I got into doing the vitamins and the herbs and all these other things for getting a cold, I used to take those cold medicines. And I can remember doing it and thinking that the medicine made me feel worse than the cold did, and yet I would still do it anyway.
Well, that's because you thought you were supposed to. I mean, we get brainwashed by the direct-to-consumer ads that are all over the place telling us that what we should be doing is taking this pill because it's going to make something happen.
If you can find an acupuncturist that's willing to treat you when you have a cold. Boy, I've had some deep chest colds, had the acupuncture really make a difference.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the questions you have to ask yourself is, do you think the pharmaceutical industry knew about this? Do you think they realized that this didn't do much for the cold?
Well, they're talking about the fever and the sore throat, the pain and the headache.
But the point is there wasn't any improvement, and it didn't affect the virus. I mean, look at Tamiflu, something that's used to treat influenza. That shortens the course of influenza that might be a 5 to 7 day event by one half of 1 day and puts you at risk for all the side effects of Tamiflu. It's like insanity, and yet they're still promoting it. The pharmaceutical company is promoting the heck out of it, making you think that if you don't have your Tamiflu stashed away and there's an influenza epidemic, that this is what's going to save your life.
Yeah, there's ways to do this without drugs to help you to feel a little better. And I know that the humidifier and I know that the nasal irrigations can make a huge difference. And cough drops.
How about going to bed and
getting
some rest?
But I mean,
you know?
It's hard to sleep if your nose is plugged up. But if you can do these other things.
You can use nose drops for a couple of days. You're not going to get addicted to nose drops in a couple of days. And if
it
opens up your passage.
Yeah, but you don't need to if you can do the humidifier.
If it works, it doesn't always work. A lot of people, it's the nasal congestion. They can't
breathe.
It's so bad.
Nose irrigation is helpful too.
It can help.
Try all those things first before you resort to an inhaler.
Okay, and how about living a healthy lifestyle? Think that makes a difference? It lowers your resistance?
Well,
maybe
getting enough sleep and eating right instead of eating a lot of sugar. And if you reduce stress, because people often get sick from stress.
Well, when do people get colds? It's, you know, when you're in college, everybody's got a cold just before finals.
The other thing is a lot of people are used to putting that Vicks Vapor Rub on their chest, but remember, that's petroleum.
Yeah, not a good
idea.
And
that's not a healthy thing. That's carcinogenic oil, you know. So eucalyptus oil, you could mix that with some almond oil or coconut oil or any other kind of healthy oil.
Well, that's right.
And put that on yourself, and that'll have the same effect.
You know, another cause of frequent incidents of colds is low vitamin D levels, particularly in the wintertime when we don't have enough vitamin D in our body. And we know that vitamin D does a lot to boost immunity. And the way it does it is there are two arms of the immune system, one that makes antibodies and the other that makes cells that fight viral infections and cancers. And if you don't have vitamin D, your body will make plenty of the antibodies, but antibodies aren't what fight viruses for the most part. That's mainly done by the cells of the immune system.
I know that if I boost my vitamin D,
it helps.
The first like 3 or 4 days, it really makes a difference. If I get it right at the beginning when I think, I wonder if I'm getting a cold, and then if I take it, it'll just knock it out. But I have to take a lot of it.
Well, I think it's one of those things that if there really was a flu epidemic that was a serious one, people could take 50,000 international units of vitamin D a day in that setting, and it probably would save a lot of lives and make a lot of those infections.
Well, a lot of people are afraid that that's too high of a dosage, but if you just do it for 3 or 4 days, it's probably not going
to In general, and we're not giving advice to anybody. What we're giving is information that may help you to, you know, that you can bring up with your doctor and see what your doctor recommends, considering your whole health situation. So this business of not taking care of ourselves is what leads to getting colds, and then if we do get the cold, we get desperate to want to do something about it, so we start looking at the cold and flu remedies that apparently don't do much, because here's a study that shows that that's the scenario. So here we are. All right, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and we'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio. And when we come back, we'll be talking about a new risk for colon cancer that might surprise you, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
Ever heard the expression, you are what you eat?
Sure have.
How about what you eat or don't eat may lead to disease?
Heard that one too.
Well, colon or colorectal cancer is a dreaded disease, and we already know that red meat and alcohol are risk factors for it. And now a Michigan study shows that the interaction between inflammation and the microbes in the GI system can result in colon tumors. How does this play out?
Yeah, this is really fascinating, and it's getting to a place where the mainstream is beginning to understand that the microflora of the intestinal tract, which is a very complex ecosystem that has thousands of different species of microbes and trillions of microbes, has a profound effect on the physiology of how the body works. They even use the term dysbiosis, which I haven't seen used in the mainstream very often. And just so you understand what that is, it's a contracture for the word dyssymbiosis, which doesn't help you much. But it basically says that there's a relationship between the microbes that's saprophytic and
us. That's real helpful, too.
Well, it means they live off us and we live off them. That's what a saprophytic relationship is.
So we want a balance.
Yeah. So one that is dysbiosis is one that's out of balance. And very often that causes different kinds of health problems for us. And one of the things that we know is associated with colon cancer is an abnormal microflora in the gut. And we get to this question that's a chicken egg question. Which comes first and which causes what?
The microbes come from the cancer or the cancer comes from the microbes?
Well, it's sort of like yes. So what we have is an article that came out in a journal called MBio, which is a major journal for the American Society of Microbes, of Microbiology. And what they did is they transferred microbes from a mouse, okay, that had colon tumors to a germ-free mouse, and they did this to a lot of mice. And what they found was, is when they did that, it doubled the risk of cancer of the mice that got the microflora that had the cancer, the colon cancer.
So what we need to be clear of here is that they weren't transferring the cancer cells.
No.
They were transferring the microbes.
A little bit of stool is what it boils down to. And what happened is it actually doubled the risk for it. So we're looking at something that is very interesting, because could it be that it's the microbes that are in the gut that actually stimulate the production of cancer?
Well, what they found, I guess, was that flora, those microbes, stimulated inflammation, and then the inflammation changes the microbes to cause the tumors, so they make each other worse.
Well, that's exactly what happened. That's right. And the way they proved that is they treated one group of mice who they gave the stool from the colon cancer mice with antibiotics before and after they made the transplantation, and another group that didn't. And in the group where they had given the antibiotics, which killed, of course, most of the bugs that were transferred across, the risk for colon cancer wasn't anywhere near what it was in the ones that didn't receive the antibiotics. So it's saying that the microbes themselves have a profound effect at causing cancer. We already knew that inflammation was important for causing cancer, and that's why people who have ulcerative colitis, for example, have a very high risk for colon cancer.
Well, so would you order an antibiotic for one of your patients that had these bad bacteria in it?
I probably wouldn't because I don't like the idea of wiping out the whole microflora of the gut. But what I might do is add a probiotic.
Because that would crowd out the bad bacteria?
It would crowd out the bad bacteria. And I'd also change the diet around. And these are changes that occur over years and years to actually result in the development of colon cancer in people. So, no, I wouldn't do that, but it raises an interesting question is, can you prevent a cancer by treating the intestinal tract with oral antibiotics?
Well, I think people need to be aware of also inflammatory bowel disease and ulcerative colitis, because those are inflammation in the bowel, and those mixed with the bad bacteria could cause the colon or colorectal cancer.
Well, that's what happens in people with ulcerative colitis. So many of them wind up with a colectomy. They actually take the colon out because there are so many cancers that develop. If you have rip-roaring ulcerative colitis as a child or as a young person, 20 years later, your chance of having colon cancer probably 40 or 50%. So a lot of these people, it's really important to keep the inflammation down by controlling the ulcerative colitis.
So it would be good for all those people to be taking probiotics then, huh?
Absolutely. And that's why we should be supporting the wellness of the gut. And to do that, there are lots of things you can do, like add L-glutamine, which is a major metabolic fuel of the small intestinal cells that help it repair itself. And to use quercetin, which is a bioflavonoid that reduces the allergic and inflammation that's in the gut. To use something like Ultra Clear Sustain, which is a wonderful product that has probably 50 or 75 different things in it. The gut says, thank you very much for giving me, because now I can get well. So if you can reduce the inflammation of people with ulcerative colitis or inflammatory bowel disease, you're doing a lot to change that risk for the disease itself as well as the cancer that comes and is associated with it.
What were the names of these bad bacteria?
Oh, they got long names. I'm not sure we want to go there. One of them was Bacteroides. That one you can understand, but nobody much would know the names of the others. But these investigators studied which microbes were there and found that when certain ones were there, they could predict who was going to get cancer and who wasn't at a higher rate. So this is it's kind of a very important concept to put in our minds, because what it's turning out to show us is that the microflora of the gut has a profound effect on our biochemistry and physiology. It has more metabolic activity than any organ system in the body. And it has 10 times as many microbes as we have cells in the whole human body. So to ignore the physiology and biochemistry of what's going on in the gut in terms of its effect on the rest of the body is just naive. But we're making great progress, and now the National Institutes of Health is studying this a lot, and we're finding associations with lots of diseases like diabetes and obesity and heart disease and now cancer. So that medicine of the future may be altering the kinds of microbes that live in the gut to change around our risk for developing certain diseases. Sounds weird, because most of the time when we think of stool, we don't think of anything that's important. It's like a waste product that does nothing.
Well, I know that MDs didn't used to really pay any attention to this, but they are starting to now. I know a lot of times I talk to my friends and they might say, oh, the doctor put me on an antibiotic, and I'll say, well, are you taking a probiotic? And
right.
They'll say, yes. The
yeah.
doctor told
yeah.
him to take the probiotic. And it
yeah.
used to be I'd say that, and it was like, what is that supposed to do?
10 years ago, there was very little in my local hospital of doctors thinking about using probiotics. I've been using for about 30 years, actually. I even was using them before I got into this field of nutrition, because I knew, just my own common sense told me, this is a good thing to do. And if you're trying to quiet down an illness and you know it's caused by a microbe in the gut, doesn't it make a lot of sense to try and crowd it out? And that's, of course, the most sensible thing to do.
So a lot of people want to know if it's enough to eat yogurt to add that into your diet. And we see these ads for Activia, the different ones, the Yoplait and
they're
whatever.
Better than doing nothing. And it's a good thing to pay attention to that. But in actuality, it's what you eat.
Of course, a lot of them are pasteurized, so they kill the bacteria, and then they put the bacteria back in.
Well, it doesn't do that much
good. And they put a lot of jam and different flavorings and things in there that are sweet that kind of cancel it out.
Well, think about it this way.
The real thing to get is the organic plain yogurt.
Yeah, that's not pasteurized. Yeah,
unpasteurized.
Right. All right, so the main thing then here is to remember that the relationship we have with the microflora that live in the intestinal tract is very important, and we should be trying to preserve it rather than not taking an antibiotic. For example, when I was in medical school, everybody was taking acromycin at the time if they got a cold, thinking that if you had a cold, it can't hurt you any. But it sure as heck can. So we're learning a lot about
that. They don't do anything for viruses.
Well, that's right. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on Confucius Didn't Say. Now, there's a twist. And when we come back, we're talking about what does the brain have to do with type 2 diabetes, and why are people going out of the country to get medical care? So stay tuned.
Confucius say, listen carefully to get your laughs.
because that's important for good health.
Ah, so.
Confucius didn't say, man who wants pretty nurse must be patient.
Oh, jeez.
Passionate kiss like spiderweb leads to undoing of fly.
Oh, that's terrible.
Lady who goes camping must beware of evil intent.
Oh, Vicky.
Squirrel who runs up woman's leg will not find nuts.
Oh, jeez.
Man who leaps off cliff jumps to conclusion.
Oh, true.
Man who runs in front of car gets tired. Man who runs behind car gets exhausted.
Oh, that's rotten.
We need one of those sound effect things.
Yes, we do.
Man who eats many prunes get good run for money. Nothing like running with the runs. Okay.
All right.
War does not determine who is right. It determines who is left.
That's great.
Man who fight with wife all day get no peace at night.
Oh, Vicky. This is nurse. What's this? Nurse Vicky does New York or what?
This is Confucius didn't say.
All right.
Okay. Man who drives like hell is bound to get there.
That's right.
Man who stands on toilet is high on pot. Man who live in glass house should change clothes in basement. Man who fish in other man's well often catches crap.
Oh, my goodness.
Finally, Confucius did not say, a lion will not cheat on his wife, but a tiger would. Oh.
Where do you find these things? Know, that's hilarious.
That one was a little old.
Well, I think
Tiger Wood.
Well, there we go. I mean, laughter is the best medicine. You just got your 5-minute laugh for the day, right?
That's it.
All right.
With type 2 diabetes on the rise, there's a lot of talk about prevention of obesity and less sugar in our diet because these are known risk factors for diabetes. But once the cat's out of the bag, are we trying to cure it? Or just treat the symptoms by treating insulin levels? Well, there's more to this story that's been skipped over since the 1920s that deals with the key role of the brain in glucose regulation partnering with the pancreas. So let's start with talking about what happened in the 1920s that changed the focus of research and the treatment of diabetes.
Yeah, see, this was huge. Banding and Best in the early 20s discovered insulin and synthesized the molecule. So all of a sudden, all these people were dying from type 1 diabetes in ketoacidosis, which is a miserable death, because they had no insulin to control blood sugar levels, were being cured of the symptoms that they were having. And so replacing insulin was exactly the thing that we thought was the whole story. But it turns out it's not.
So that was for type 1 diabetes.
Type 1 diabetes. And sometimes you can use insulin in type 2 diabetes as well, because the idea that we've had all this time is that we should be using treatments that either increase insulin levels by giving insulin or by giving drugs that raise levels and increasing the body's sensitivity to insulin so that you need less of it. And that's fine, except what we found out years later is that there's another mechanism that controls blood sugar levels, and it's called glucose effectiveness. And what that means is that we have an effect that's not dependent on insulin. It's independent of insulin activity that increases glucose utilization in the tissues. So that drops blood sugar levels and also drops the production, reduces the production of glucose from glycogen in the liver or from muscles.
Okay, let's backtrack a little bit here so everybody can understand.
Okay.
So when there's too much glucose in the blood,
it by itself has an effect that's called glucose effectiveness that lowers blood sugar levels by increasing its utilization in the tissues and burning it to make ATP.
So in other words, we want the glucose in our tissues, in our cells. We don't want it in our bloodstream.
Yes, but the glucose itself has an effect, okay, that turns out to be orchestrated by the hypothalamus, okay, in the brain. So these researchers who did this work at the University of Washington in Seattle, from the University of Cincinnati in Michigan and in Munich, did this study that was published in Nature in 2013 that showed that there are two effects that are important that manage blood sugar levels, one being insulin and the other being this thing called glucose effectiveness that is managed by the brain.
So would you say that the glucose effectiveness rivals the insulin mechanisms?
It not only rivals it, sometimes it's more important. In normal situations, about 50% of the effect of managing blood sugar levels is from the level of sugar itself that's mediated by the brain, by the hypothalamus. In people who are obese and insulin resistance, it accounts for more than 80% of the effect. And in people who have severe insulin resistance and don't have enough insulin, which is what this disease, type 2 diabetes, eventually leads to, 99%. So insulin's important, but so is the effect of the brain in managing the sensitivity.
So what you're saying then is that diabetes is the failure of the brain and the pancreatic those little islets.
Production of insulin, that's right. It's the failure of both, and that's what this study showed.
And yet they work together.
They absolutely work together, but to get type 2 diabetes, you have to have a failure of both.
So the brain impairment would lead to a burden on the islet of the pancreas
of this production of insulin,
and then vice versa.
Yes,
and that would lead to diabetes.
The way you have to have both of them, and usually what happens is the islet cell system, the production of insulin, takes over when the brain part doesn't do its job. But when it fails, it makes the strain on the brain even worse, and the production of insulin worse, and you wind up with a vicious cycle that leads to type 2 diabetes.
So when we're boosting these insulin levels, like what's been going on since the 20s, I guess,
yes,
that only decreases the glucose, and
that's just
one half of the problem.
That just decreases the insulin part, okay? I mean, if we're trying to treat the insulin failure of production or of sensitivity, that's one important part, and that's what we focused on the whole time. But it's not looking at the whole picture, so we're finding out it's far more complex than we ever thought.
So now we have to figure out how to treat the brain involvement and look at that bigger picture.
Well, that's right, and I don't think we have a clue about what to do there yet, but I'm quite certain what's going to happen is that we're going to have environmental factors that are important that affect how the brain and how the islet cells work. And that are huge in this setting.
Well, the first step always is recognizing what the problem is, what the situation is, and
well,
it seems like they just kind of like blocked it out because they thought that they had the answer with just the insulin.
But at the beginning, that was true, but it was back in the 90s, maybe even before that, that we knew about this business of insulin effectiveness. What we didn't know is that it was being controlled by neuronal circuits in the hypothalamus and other brain areas. So we've got a
So now we know that there's this partnership with the pancreas and the brain.
Yeah. So once again, as we delve deeper into things, we're finding out that we didn't know as much as we did. Now, it doesn't mean that what we're doing wasn't good. It was definitely a step in the right direction. But we still need to go back to lifestyle because that's what allows the body to self-regulate in a healthy way. If we eat right, we exercise right. Those are really huge things for type 2 diabetes.
Well, of course, prevention is the best thing that you can do.
But it's lifestyle medicine. Remember?
But a lot of people can reverse it with the lifestyle.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So with diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep, lowering cortisol levels, avoiding toxic exposures in the environment, weighing what you should, these are all factors that have the most powerful effect we can have on the development of type 2 diabetes. Type 1 is another story, and it's a different disease, and it's primarily caused by a loss of insulin production altogether by an autoimmune mechanism. And when that happens, you have to replace insulin. How much that has to do with the brain, I'm not so sure, but in type 2 diabetes, it's clear.
And then what about some of the medications that people take instead of insulin for diabetes?
Well, those are all designed to lower blood sugar levels by increasing the production of insulin in the pancreas or by increasing the sensitivity of insulin, meaning it increasing its power, its ability to do things, to lower blood sugar. And that's a way to go, but it doesn't do a whole lot, and all of those medicines have terrible side effects. They actually cause the problem we're trying to prevent, which is the complications of diabetes, like the heart attacks and the strokes.
Really?
They actually go up with the treatment of that. So we've got two things that are become an issue. One is to regulate blood sugar better, because it's really important to keep the blood sugar levels down, because they increase the complications of diabetes, all those things we just mentioned. And the other, of course, is to just do it in a natural sort of way, which is what we should be doing.
Okay. You know, we hear this expression, does the grass look greener on the other side? But if you were really sick and you couldn't afford care at home, would you be willing to travel to another country for care? Now, researchers are now showing that more and more people are traveling across national borders to receive medical treatment and transplants and other types of surgeries. Many go for treatments that they can't receive here that are alternative to mainstream, and others are going because it's cheaper to go elsewhere. So that's right. How do we know that we can trust the care that we'll get? And why do major medical centers like Harvard and Johns Hopkins and Duke encourage medical tourism?
Well, see, you're talking about the business of medicine now. And when, to begin with, if you can't get a service that's in the United States because it doesn't exist, because the FDA hasn't approved it, and the medical boards will give you all kinds of problems if you try to practice that way, you've got to leave whatever state you're in or leave the country to go to Mexico or Europe or Australia or some other place where you can get that treatment. That's understandable, but that's not really medical tourism. Medical tourism is where you go to another country to get treatment at a lower cost, because the cost might be just 10 or 15 or 20% of what you pay in this country. And if you can't afford it, because you don't have the money and you don't have insurance,
and you're desperate.
Well, say you need a heart transplant or a lung transplant or a kidney transplant. You may spend $300,000 or more to do that in this country without insurance. And if you go to a country like that, you may spend something like $50,000 or $60,000, which you might be able to come up with.
But do you get what you pay for?
Sometimes you do, but some of these places are pretty good, and the treatment's not that bad. But you have to be sure that what you're getting is treatment from a place that's really a good place. I mean, it should be accredited by the Joint Commission International, which really has accredited 368 international hospitals in 46 different countries. And when you talk about places like Harvard and Hopkins and Duke, that being in this business in other countries, it becomes no more than a business. What they're doing is fighting for market share. And so they're taking a business that would be in another country, providing services under the name of those institutions, which is usually very appealing to people who are going out
of the
country.
In other words, they know that those people can't afford to do it here. So
yes,
if they're going to go someplace else, they want to get a cut of it.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to get everything they can here, and then they want more. So they go into that market as well. And who would you trust? Somebody from Harvard or somebody from Indonesia? It's pretty straightforward. That's how the logic works.
Well, so where do people start if they want to do it and they want to go to a place that is reputable? I mean, there are these concierge services. What's with that?
Well, those are places that have studied what's available in different countries. They hopefully looked to make sure that they were Joint Commission International certified. And they make the arrangements for you so that it becomes seamless. And that's a great thing, because you definitely want to have the best treatment that you can. And that's what people are doing. So
the catch is, too, though, you need to look into a lot of the things. You need to really check it out and also find out about the risks of flying in an airplane afterwards. Not
or
just
before,
from,
yeah.
Yeah, because you can get blood clots.
Especially after a surgery, that's
and
right.
And also, what happens if you get an infection or you have some sort of a complication?
Well, all of a sudden, now things get real tough. If you do the standard thing, you know, you're going over there for your facelift or for your problem because you want to bypass and can't afford it in this country, or you want to get a hip replacement for, you know, for $5,000 or $7,000 instead of $50,000 or $40,000. I mean, those are things that you might want to consider.
And you need to be careful about the ethical issues, too, with the transplants, because there is something called organ trafficking, where they skimp on immunosuppressants and so forth.
It gets complicated, but we're out of time. We can't go any further.
So, if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we discussed, you can go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
We'll see you next time.